From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a humanitarian pause proposed in the fighting in Yemen. Chances of the latest Syrian negotiations succeeding.
Clearly, there is no military solution, but at the same time, there's no political solution.
Israel's Netanyahu forms a coalition government with a slim majority. And Germany holds a refugee summit as asylum applications soar. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. and Saudi officials have agreed to pursue a humanitarian pause in Yemen, where Saudi-led airstrikes have sought Houthi fighters. The rebels are battling militiamen loyal to Yemen's exiled president, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi, who fled to Saudi Arabia for his own safety. The Houthis back Yemen's former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh. A pause would allow in humanitarian aid. The UN and Yemeni NGO believe as many as 20 million people, about 80% of the population, is going hungry. VOA correspondent Pamela Dawkins is traveling with the U.S. Secretary of State and spoke with us from Riyadh.
Well, Susan, the U.S. and Saudi officials have agreed to pursue a humanitarian pause in Yemen, where fighting by Houthi rebels has forced thousands of people to flee from the country. In a Thursday news conference, Secretary of State Kerry and his Saudi counterpart said efforts were underway to forge a five-day pause in Yemen to send in humanitarian aid. They said the ceasefire would be renewable depending on the conditions on the ground. The Saudi foreign minister said there had been no initial contact with the Houthis in terms of whether or not they would abide by the ceasefire, but both sides urged them to do so. He said there would be more details within the coming days about the proposed plan, which would affect all of Yemen. The Saudi foreign minister said there will be a ceasefire everywhere or a ceasefire nowhere. He added that he hoped the Houthis would care enough about the Yemeni people to support the plan.
Pamela, what kind of aid is needed?
Aid is needed from a wide variety of sources in Yemen because of the humanitarian situation. There's been an ongoing need for fuel and also for basic supplies such as food, clothing, and shelter for those who've been displaced in the conflict. Yesterday, while in Djibouti, the Secretary of State announced that the United States was providing an additional $68 million in humanitarian assistance to help Yemen. And today, the Saudi foreign minister said his country was sending about $274 million in humanitarian aid.
This was the main purpose of the Secretary of State's visit there, wasn't it?
Certainly, it was a focal point. The secretary said that he and Saudi leaders did discuss other issues of regional interest, such as the Iran nuclear negotiations, the unrest in Syria, and also the upcoming Camp David meeting in which the GCC foreign ministers will participate.
VOA State Department correspondent Pamela Dawkins reporting to us from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Mideast analyst Ian Lustick of the University of Pennsylvania tells VOA's Victor Beatty, a big question is, can the United States persuade Saudi Arabia to get out of the Yemeni conflict altogether?
Their actions have dragged the United States into a multilateral mess where we are confronting multiple enemies in the Arabian Gulf while a situation is created that makes it increasingly difficult to deal with the Iranian situation and the ISIS situation. I'm very sad about the situation in Yemen. I think we have been dragged into something that we should never have allowed ourselves to be dragged into.
Is that because we allowed and backed, in fact, the Saudi air campaign?
That's right. And I think we were in a difficult place because the Saudis are such important allies to us, and they have a new government or the new king. And that new government is taking decisions in a way that previous Saudi governments have not. The current king has consolidated power around himself and a few close relatives and has closed himself off in many respects to the wider consultations with the political class in Saudi Arabia that had always tended to make decisions by the Saudi government more prudent and risk-averse. Here you see a very bold, even reckless policy that seems like it's generated more by an internal politics in Saudi Arabia and by some kind of moral panic that the Shia need to be confronted in some way more vigorously by Saudi power. For all we have seen, the Saudi onslaught has not stopped the expansion of Houthi power. Repeatedly, the press has published maps showing Houthi expansion into regions well beyond where they occupied prior to the Saudi air campaign. It's unlikely that the Houthis could be stopped since they have an alliance with most of the Yemeni army, loyal essentially to the former dictator. So it's not just a matter of ceding Yemen to the Houthis. It's really the Houthis in alliance with the tribes and the military that were associated with the previous dictator.
How big a role, if any, is Iran playing in this crisis?
I do not believe Iran is playing a very big role. You have to go back to the fact that although the Houthis are Shia, they are not the same kind of Shia as the Iranians. And they were allied with the Saudis in the earlier Yemen war when the Saudis fought the Egyptians. So these are not Houthis with a diabolical enmity towards Saudi Arabia. They are former allies. They are hardened fighters. But you also have al-Qaeda in southeastern Yemen, and they had an interest in transforming the struggle in Yemen into one in which they could claim that they, the paragons of virtue of Sunni Islam in their lights, were defending Sunnis against the Shia heretics. So they're the ones that wanted the conflict to be defined as a Shia-Sunni conflict instead of an internal tribal and political conflict in Yemen. And the Saudis jumped on that bandwagon, and the United States has been dragged in behind them, even as we are trying to sort out the different kinds of relationships we need to have with Shia Iran over the nuclear weapons and over containing ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
Lustig says the Houthis are natural enemies of the Sunni al-Qaeda fighters in Yemen, and like Iran fighting alongside the U.S.-backed Iraqi government against the Islamic State, Washington could find itself in an unlikely alliance with the Houthis against al-Qaeda in Yemen. The United Nations is hosting indirect talks between rival sides involved in the conflict in Syria. 4 to 6 weeks of talks are planned in Geneva. UN envoy Staffan de Mistura is said to be meeting separately with each party, including both government and opposition representatives. The Islamic State group and the al-Qaeda-linked Jabhat al-Nusra have not been invited. UN officials described the latest round of talks as an effort to see whether the will and conditions exist to restart the peace process. Two earlier rounds of talks broke down more than a year ago. They were aimed at brokering a ceasefire and launching a Syrian-led political transition that would lead the country out of crisis. Since then, however, the challenge in Syria has grown more complex. Islamic State fighters have seized large areas in the eastern part of the country, while existing rebel and militant groups are continuing to battle pro-government forces. VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy spoke with Edmund Gharib of American University in Washington about the chances of success for this latest international effort to end the Syrian conflict.
Professor Gharib, both Secretary of State John Kerry and White House National Security Advisor Susan Rice stressed that there is no military solution to the Syrian conflict. However, training and equipping the Syrian opposition fighters will start this month. How do you explain that?
Clearly, there is no military solution, but at the same time, there is no political solution. So what we are seeing and what we're likely to see is continued support for the parties, basically in the hope of gaining an advantage. And they also will try to change the political realities on the ground, the political and military balance on the ground, because there is a perception, there is a belief that we're not likely to see any changes in any real opportunities for dialogue unless there is the beginning of a change in the balance of power on the ground inside Syria. And so one of the main reasons behind the support which is being provided to the Syrian opposition is to help create this kind of balance in order to strengthen the chances of reaching some kind of a negotiation and the beginning of real negotiations between the different players.
Talking about that, UN envoy to Syria started an effort to explore whether the Syrian government and the opposition representatives are ready to restart a political dialogue to end the conflict. Could the rising threat from ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra compel the two sides to compromise this time?
That possibility is always there, although I think it's still highly unlikely that we're going in that direction right now. I think the UN envoy de Mistura, what he's trying to do is he's trying to explore the chances between the different parties, the different players. He's inviting numerous groups as well as individuals who are active in the Syrian opposition, in addition to a delegation from the Syrian government. So as a result of this, what I think what de Mistura is trying to do, he's trying to listen to the different parties in the hope that finding ways to try to bridge the differences among the two sides and whether or not this possibility exists. And if he finds that it does exist, then we are likely to move from consultations to negotiations. There have been a number of statements coming out that probably the end of this phase will be at the end of June, at the same time that the Iran negotiations are likely to end, although the Mistura has also said that he will not have an automatic cut-off, but he will continue to a later period. But I think the most significant part of this is that what de Mistura also may be trying to do is to sound out the different parties which support different groups, whether it's the parties which support the Syrian regime on the one hand or the parties which support the Syrian opposition, be they regional players or international players, to find out whether or not they are ready to sit down and to reach some kind of a compromise, because I think their role, we are not likely to see a significant change unless the big players are also, who are supporting this or that party, are also willing to begin to reach some kind of an accommodation and to find out that their interests may require them to begin to reach an accommodation between the different players.
Iran was not invited to the previous Geneva meetings on Syria. And there are reports saying that it has been invited to this UN informal peace effort. How could that impact the prospects of success?
Primarily, there have been attempts to try to bring Iran in. If you remember, Lakhdar al-Brahimi wanted to do that. There were others who wanted to include Iran in the negotiations. But there was, at that time, very strong opposition, including from the United States, to Iranian participation. I think that there is a growing recognition, but in part as a result of the negotiations between Iran and 5+1, and also because of the changing realities on the ground, that perhaps it might be very useful to have Iran play a role. Iran is known for its support of the Syrian regime, and as a result of that, it's one of the major players. So I think there is going to be an effort to find out where does Iran stand, and could it be possible that Iran could perhaps pressure the Syrian regime to try to make some accommodations with the opposition? And I think this, to a certain extent, also applies to Russia. There is a general belief that because these two countries are supporting the Syrian regime, there is a need to explore and find out where they are likely to make some changes in their stand, and if they are ready to make those changes. At the same time, I think the Russians and the Iranians are likely to also see if they can get concessions from the backers of the Syrian opposition. And so there might be an opportunity at least to begin to have a real dialogue, but I don't think that we're likely to see that happen until we begin to see where the Iranian negotiations over the nuclear issue, where those are going.
Edmund Gharib, professor of Middle East history at American University in Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a new coalition government and is poised to begin an unprecedented fourth term as head of government. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the new government after 7 weeks of bargaining and less than 2 hours before a deadline that would have seen the task pass to another parliament member. He says he is sure no one is surprised the negotiations took a while with all the factions, but no one is surprised they ended on time. He says he wants to swear in the new government next week and indicates he hopes to strengthen it by attracting other parties. Mr. Netanyahu was chosen to form the next government after his Likud party defeated in the March elections an opposition alliance led by the rival Labor Party. Labor leader Yitzhak Herzog reiterated that he would not join the new coalition.
All I can say is that the government to be formed is a failed government, which will lead nowhere, which will lead Israel into dangerous directions. We will present a strong, firm opposition that will not enable the government one moment of ability to function. We will challenge it on all fronts.
The new government was formed with a one-seat majority of 61 parliament members. Mr. Netanyahu had hoped to form a larger coalition, but former ally Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman withdrew his right-wing party from the coalition talks. As a result, Mr. Netanyahu was obliged to ally with the ultra-Orthodox religious parties and the hard-line Jewish Home Party of former Economy Minister Naftali Bennett, who advocates expanding Jewish settlements and annexing parts of the Palestinian West Bank. A leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization and former chief peace negotiator Nabil Shaath said the new government gave no hope of advancing the Middle East peace process.
This is a colonial settler cabinet, no doubt about it. It's an extreme right cabinet. It's a cabinet that includes all of those people who want to maintain our occupation. And that's what I said about my very, very little hope that this government is going to really be at all a government of peace.
The Middle East peace process has been stalled since the collapse 1 year ago of U.S.-led negotiations and the subsequent 50-day conflict between Israel and Hamas-led militants in the Gaza Strip. A majority of the Israeli electorate also seemed to see little hope for advancing the peace negotiations. The election campaign focused primarily on domestic issues such as the rising cost of living and the growing gap between rich and poor. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Germany is to hold a summit on refugees Friday, as the number of people seeking asylum in the country has doubled in a year. Close to 30,000 migrants are believed to have crossed the Mediterranean from Africa to Europe so far in 2015, with many heading north in the hope of finding better welfare programs and jobs. Henry Ridgewell has been following the migrants' trail through Europe and took the train from Italy to Munich, Germany.
The first migrants boarded the Verona to Munich express train at Brenner, the last stop in Italy on the mountainous Austrian border. They were mostly Somalis and Eritreans. They carried no possessions. Nervously, they made their way through the cars. Some sat in vacant seats, others waited in corridors. The first police officers came aboard at Rosenheim, just inside Germany, and began checking passports. One by one, the migrants were led off the train. After half an hour, more than 70 were lined up on the platform as the other passengers stared through the windows. Under Europe's so-called Dublin regulations, migrants are meant to apply for asylum in the country where they first arrive, so they often refuse to reveal their identity or give fingerprints until they get to their final destination, often Germany or other wealthy northern European states. Few migrants want to stay in southern Europe, explains Rebecca Killian-Mason of the Munich Refugee Council.
Like in Greece, you have huge problems, and in Greece no one is sent back to Greece at the moment because the situation is so awful. With Italy, there are still a lot of people sent back to Italy through Dublin, and that is quite problematic because a lot of people are homeless in Italy. They don't get social support.
But they do get that support in Germany. 173,000 people applied for asylum here in 2014. The rate has doubled in 2015. Among them is James from Sierra Leone. He's now living in refugee accommodation in Munich, but first set foot in Europe by illegally entering the Spanish enclave of Melilla in North Africa. He hopes the German authorities will look kindly on his asylum application.
It hurts me when I heard that maybe they're going to send me back to Spain. Sometimes it hurts me. I just don't want to think about it. Yeah, I can tell you, me being here is worth risking life for.
The huge number of asylum cases means the authorities are overwhelmed, so only a fraction of those eligible are actually returned to their country of arrival, says Franziska Fassbinder, who provides free advice to migrants through the Munich Refugee Law Clinic.
Because we have only a short time slot where they can bring this person back. This is about 6 months. And when a refugee comes to Germany, we often tell him or her just to wait.
Many asylum seekers are rejected on the grounds that they are economic migrants rather than refugees fleeing war. It is a difficult distinction, argues Fassbinder.
I would also ask the question, is it really an economic reason if I can't get any food?
Rich European nations like Germany are famous for their welfare programs and social care, but the influx of migrants fleeing both war and poverty is testing the will of governments and people across the continent. Henry Richwell for VOA News, Munich, Germany.
Companies are capitalizing on the future of space travel thanks to an evolving partnership with the U.S. space agency, NASA. Public and private sector experts met at the Milken Institute Global Conference in Los Angeles, California, to talk about the future of space flight. Correspondent Elizabeth Lee has details.
One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
46 years after NASA first put a man on the moon, much has changed about spaceflight, says NASA official William Gerstenmaier.
There's a tremendous new environment out there where it's no longer just the government doing this. The private sector wants to do this. So then my job in the government side is, how do I figure out how to team with this private sector that has this quickness, has this entrepreneurial spirit, that I can team and use that with the government side to actually move us forward?
NASA and some of the players in the private sector met in Los Angeles to discuss the future of space exploration. Naveen Jain, co-founder of the aerospace company Moon Express, has high hopes that space tourism will explode.
If you're getting married or getting engaged, why give someone a diamond? If you love her enough, you will give her the moon.
But traveling to the moon may not be viable at this time, says Lockheed Martin's Michael Hawes.
I think it is somewhat still science fiction, but mostly not because that it can't technically be done, but I don't see the market place evolving for that as quickly as some do.
Work is being done on future travel to deep space. Hawes notes that NASA has conducted a successful test flight of Orion, its next-generation spacecraft, which will eventually explore the moon and beyond. NASA is also looking to private industry to service the International Space Station.
So they have a couple companies providing cargo. They have a couple companies that have been contracted to provide crew in the future.
NASA is also looking to the private sector for space travel research that can have benefits on Earth, too. They include advances in technologies such as miniature cameras on cell phones and finding solutions to health problems in space, which can also help the people on Earth.
What we see in space is the human body, for some reason, where there's tremendous bone loss. On the order of 20 to 30% of your bones can be lost per month in space if you don't do any kind of physical exercise. That occurs in our elderly population.
Boeing's John L. Bond says the research opportunities are exciting, but solving space-related problems takes time.
In 100 years from now, there'll be a commercial space industry that you can't imagine today what it will be like, based on kind of where we are now. So it's we have to be careful not to lose sight of how difficult these things are. At the same time, we can't lose the enthusiasm that there's going to be a heck of a lot of opportunity in front of us.
And space experts say that opportunity could even lead to colonizing Mars. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. You can also re-listen to our program if you'd like to. Just go to our website and go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner. and scroll on down to International Edition and hit listen. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.